This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Ryan England. Ryan, it's great having you back on.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined here with Pill Eater and Rabbit.
Hey there.
Hey, guys.
Ryan, you're involved with the alt-left movement. What have been some of your overall observations about some of the trends since the last time we talked? I think it was December.
Yeah, that was just after we found out Trump won.
Oh yeah, the election roundtable, right?
Yeah. I think it was a little bit far, maybe a bit farther back than December. I'm not really too sure. As to the trends, there seems to be quite, I'm noticing a fairly consistent interest in, in terms of people, wanting to join the Facebook groups and so forth. But it's going through some kind of strange cycles.
Are you talking about changes? Because we've talked about the different factions. There's the sort of left wing of the alt-right, and then there's a lot of the new entryist, and then there's the whole thing going on with Lindsay parting ways with the left wing of the alt-right, which we can talk about later. What were you referring to specifically?
Well, generally, like if you've been following some of the some of the events, particularly following the inauguration, the riots in D.C., the riots in Berkeley, which I'm sure we'll get into, I'm getting a lot of people almost coming out of the woodwork within some of the groups that are essentially shilling for some of these, some of these more violent and extremist factions that that we've been seeing out on the streets during those, during those two events, among others. And what's odd about it is I hadn't really heard or seen much of them up until then.
And are you talking about the original supporters, or you're talking about a lot of the new entryists?
It tends to be more entryist. I think that would be it. I think that some of these Antifa types, as they call themselves, now whether or not that's what they really are, I don't know. But, I'm getting a lot of people posting with their talking points. I'm noticing that in a lot of the groups on social media. They're basically saying that you're just a, you're just a kind of a liberal sellout if you're not speaking in favor of rioting and smashing windows and so on and so forth. What's funny is that not a lot of people were really suggesting this up until it happened.
Let me jump in here, if I can, because I think a big part of that is that you have a lot of people in the media that have been misusing the term alt-left. And I think that has kind of attracted a lot of people to the label, because you have people like Sean Hannity, calling these activists and whatnot the alt-left. And so you're starting to see people actually identify as that because it's been misused in so many different mainstream articles. So they're joining these Facebook groups thinking that it's like an Antifa type thing, which, because you're dealing with people who really don't, who clearly don't have any real intellectual curiosity. Yeah. So they're not like, they didn't bother to read any of the, the actual websites that were actually associated with the alt-left. They just decided to, like, you know, go wild and start using the terminology because they heard it on TV or something, or because they think that, you know, because there's the alt-right, then naturally the opposition to it would be called the alt-left, which, you know, that's their, that's what they're thinking, but that's clearly they didn't really go into the background of it or anything beyond a superficial level.
In one of the groups that I mod, the first thing that I say in the introductory post, my first comment is, "Greetings, everybody, and welcome to the alt-left. First things first, don't believe what Fox News and other right-wing media outlets have told you what the alt-left is. If you believe what right-wing media tells you, you have come to the wrong place."
Well, that's one thing, but that doesn't, like, you know, that doesn't explain the origins of anything. So someone could come to it still being totally confused as to, you know, what it's all, because I'm starting to see, like, on Twitter and stuff, these, like, Black Power groups and whatnot, with the Black Power fist starting to identify as alt-left. And it's like, and I also, in the referrals to my website, I always find these almost kind of amusing discussion groups and, like, these other websites that have people, talking about the alt-left. And then you have, you know, some other commenters on there with brains, you know, that are part of those movements that are like, yeah, well, I just went to this site and, like, I read all these articles, like, why are you guys calling yourself alt-left? Like, have you read any of this stuff? Like, is this really what you identify with? Like, you know, because, like, in these discussion groups, I see these people, you know, starting with one premise, and then they kind of go to, they start figuring stuff out because there's some people, you know, in Reddit or whatever that aren't complete morons.
There's this whole riots going on at UC Berkeley over Milo speaking, and Milo's considered this, like, an evil racist fascist, but what Rabbit was saying on a previous show is that Milo is similar to the faction of the alt-left in the sense that he's advocating a kind of a colorblind civic nationalism based on, like, free market capitalism. Ryan, would you say it's accurate to say that a large portion of the alt-left is similar to Milo in that sense, except they're advocating a colorblind civic nationalism around economic populist or even socialist issues?
When I started my page on Facebook, Alternative Left, back in April of last year, that, believe it or not, was exactly my intention. Because I thought that somebody like a Milo Yiannopoulos, say, could have an appeal to some people, but I noticed that a lot of people on, like, say, anti-SJW sites and pages, a certain number of them seemed to be coming from an almost an old left kind of perspective. It was colorblindness as far as race and gender. They didn't like the censorship. They didn't like, the no platforming and this kind of thing. But where they would break from the mainstream of anti-SJW thought is that they were economic center to leftists to varying degrees. And I started my page with the intent of kind of appealing to that sort of mindset.
And Rabbit, would you say, consider that the core of the alt-left? Because I know you're personally more into identitarianism.
I think that, they're really, originally when I got involved with the alt-left, it was as a means, not to get away from identity politics altogether, but to, you know, to recognize and to appeal to a white identity from a different economic and cultural perspective, a different kind of, like, almost like a left-wing nationalism. but I think that probably the largest segment of what the alt left. I think that essentially was maybe too big a bridge for some people, you know. So they were like so far into the social justice territory that getting them away from identity politics was a goal for some of those people. I consider it, the quintessential person of that faction would probably be someone like Sargon or Amazing Atheist would probably fit that. In a way, I actually do identify more with the SJWs in the sense that I agree with them in the importance of having an identity, beyond just class or economics. It's just that their idea of is basically everyone can have an identity except for white people or Europeans.
And Ryan, we've talked about this before, but do you see those two ways, schools of thought inherently in conflict, or do you consider them both legitimate parts of the alt-left movement?
Another fellow that I quite like listening to, who probably falls a bit more within this alt-light purview, is another YouTuber, goes by the name of Styx Hexenhammer 666.
Oh yeah.
And he's talked a little bit about the alt-right, and he said something like, I forget exactly how he put it, but something to the effect that he kind of liked the fact that there was no single leadership, that there was no single party line, that because it sort of broadens the potential of it. I mean, somebody who might not completely fit in with Rabbit's version of it might go more for mine, or vice versa. Maybe partly because issues of white identity, perhaps for as simple a reason as, say, where you live or your hometown. Something like that might impact your perspectives on things like that. So having a single party line applicable to everybody that wants to buy into this sort of thing, I think wouldn't really be workable.
Ryan, what do you think about Robert Lindsay, Robert Lindsay was the founder of the alt-left, and Robert Lindsay has broken ties with the left wing of the alt-right faction primarily over support for Trump. Ryan, what are your thoughts on that?
Do any of you still follow his blog, Beyond Highbrow?
Sort of.
Yeah, I read it regularly still.
I mean, even since I've come to know him, he's really turned left. Like, he's kind of gone hard left.
And what I've as far as to defend the guy who attacked Richard Spencer.
I think speaking out to kind of defending the actions of the Black Bloc and this sort of thing.
Also made that post of that calling for an alliance with SJWs to attack Trump. And I don't know if you saw that he made a posting. I think it's interesting because to me it's an instance of where, it's almost like it reminds me in a way of Milo and some of these people. Like Milo does everything he can to distance himself from the alt-right and disavow any kind of racism or identity. But yet he still is attacked as being some kind of neo-Nazi white supremacist or something, which is just, and you have Lindsay, who I don't usually respond to him or go after him, because I actually think he's a really cool guy and I like him personally. So I just I try to, if people are cool to me, I just ignore stuff rather than get into a thing with him. But I just think it's interesting because if you look at the history of his posts, his posts have been reposted on the Daily Stormer before. So the idea that these people, social justice types, like they're not going to make any distinction between, someone like him or Milo or me or anything. Like you can't
or
have
even
a post.
Me.
You can't have one post. Right. You can't have one post one day that says like, Mexicans are really, they're too stupid to even bother to vote, you know, or like black people are terrible tippers. And then the next say, ally with these SJWs, they're going to be like, I don't think they're going to go for it in this idea that, we need to unite with these social justice people because, economics are more important. But you can't make a distinction between the two because a huge part of the, social justice movement and the anti-white, they tie that stuff into what their economic interests are. They want to, promote affirmative action, and they want to, take money from the first world and give it to the third world and get white people out of power and push people of color into power in these institutions. So you can't separate the two and say like, we're going to ally with these social justice people because we're just going to focus on economics, because, if you get the $15 minimum wage and all this kind of stuff, but you're doing it where you're inviting in millions of people from, Haiti and Somalia, then it's like there's a, you're still,
that's not,
there's still a conflict. Right.
And the thing about Robert Lindsay is if you talk to him on the issues, I mean, he pretty much agrees with us on most of the main issues. He supports a reduction in immigration. He's opposed to busing. I don't think he supports affirmative action. His views are very close to ours. He's just primarily because he hates Donald Trump. And a lot of some of his criticisms of Trump are legitimate, but I think it's just really petty to disown the people who are the closest to you very close to you politically and advocate an alliance with people who basically these SJW and Antifa types, if they read over Robert Lindsay's blog, would not want anything to do with him.
Oh, yeah. We hear again in the groups that I'm with and that I mod, one of the fads that I've noticed is you get people come in and we talk about wanting to, sometimes not even completely abandon identity politics, just sort of move away from it a little bit and into economic inequality and class issues somewhat. And you get just a mountain of copy pasta from these people, and they call you stuff like brocialist or class reductionist. They'll say that, and then they'll launch right into something that is an extreme kind of SJW position. In the groups that I mod on Facebook, I read 2-3 posts a day from somebody saying, I got banned from something like Red Black Anarchists or Communism 101, say, for suggesting that, maybe people of color should treat white people with respect, too, or something like that. And it's just what happens is the mods on these pages say, well, you have to self-crit or you're going to get banned. So what are these people doing that they're social justice warriors that are they're college leftists that are appropriating this sort of quasi-Marxist imagery in order to appeal to people who are starting to get the fact that economic inequality and class is a problem, but they don't really want to get into that kind of theory or activism. They don't want to leave the politics of academia and cultural leftism behind. That's what it looks like to me. No, you can't have an alliance with the SJWs. They're fanatics.
I think that, a large part of the basis for, Lindsay he basically said that he basically wouldn't support any Republican candidate. He said that he would never vote Republican. And that to me is very, very telling. And he says that he's primarily, that liberals are essentially like, he reads like Daily Kos because those are his people. Whereas, like, I'm not a party guy. Like, I'm not a party politics guy. Like, the party labels, like, are meaningless to me. Like, what the only thing that matters to me are the issues. And if you say, well, how could this person, you know, support Trump? It's like, well, because, you know, on the issues that matter to me, he was on the side that I happened to be on. Hillary was not on the side of that I was on for any issue. You know, she supports intersectional feminism. She supports, a George W. Bush style, like neo-globalist economics. She was for, intervention in all these foreign wars. She supported mass immigration. She supported TPP and free trade and all of this stuff. So she had a D next to her name, but that's, that's it. And granted, Trump isn't great, and he may not govern according to those. I've already seen him, getting into some interventionism type stuff, but he already dismantled TPP, and he went pretty hard on the immigration stuff and the national identity stuff pretty quickly. So it's like, I don't have like buyer's remorse or anything as of yet. And but I'm a Democrat or a Republican. Like, those are just, to me, those are obsolete labels.
I think this whole social justice warrior thing and the whole safe space is rather a criticism of today's decadence and what people are doing, right? It doesn't mean SJW is a part of the left, or it doesn't mean safe space is a leftist terminology. It is almost as if our established elites have filed for these terms. And this is kind of sad. At my college, I recently graduated, but a semester ago, my teachers literally took the ideal of a safe space as a serious thing that should be secure. And I thought, wait a second, that doesn't make any sense, because the word safe space is a criticism. I mean, South Park had an episode about how much of a joke even the word of safe space is. Like, how do you define a safe space? The same with social justice warrior. What a long word. It's as that is a criticism. I can't recall anyone being a proud SJW, as if that's an assaultive term. And so if you really wanted a correct left-wing politics, I don't think anybody over at Jacobin Magazine or Verso Books would ever take SJW or this concept of a safe space seriously.
They don't.
And because that just shows you how convoluted. Like, here's the thing. The alt-right is going to think, well, the left is nothing more than a social justice warrior and safe spaces. No, we've been so convoluted of what, in best definition, you might hear the word cultural Marxism state, as the alt-right likes to call, where we've been so convoluted with this decadent thing that we think that's the left, when really that it's not. And it's this sad state of affairs, even with the whole Black Lives Matter, and even Antifa will go. I think people, definitions are changing, and I think that there needs to be a complete overhaul of everything, and the alt-left is meaningful because we have to get back to the roots of what is considered a healthy, a proud stance to be considered left-wing.
Yeah, that's my thinking, exactly. I think the overwhelming majority of what's passing for leftism in the Western world these days is completely ersatz. It's utterly false. Like, every so often, to come out of academia or something like that will be this new fad cause. It's not supposed to be something that's controlled and dictated from above like that.
Yes.
What is kind of ironic is that, I mean, I supported Trump, but if Hillary Clinton were to be elected, there would be a stronger likelihood of a kind of left-wing, left-right alliance against Hillary, of the dissident left, Bernie supporters, along with Trump supporters, people on the alt-right. And that would have been more a likely possibility of a left-right alliance if Hillary were elected. But what's happening with Trump is, even if Trump does a lot of great populist things, like on trade, the media is going to paint him as this right-wing authoritarian who's going to radicalize the left. And that creates this power vacuum where the sort of the left becomes defined by the SJW types, and it makes it more difficult to create a strong dissident movement. It's still, I mean, I still think there's a lot of potential, but it does create a narrative. I mean, ironically, if Hillary were elected, there might be more likely to see more cooperation between fusionism between the left and the right, because she epitomizes like the worst of the establishment.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting to see, you know, all of these people just freaking out about things that that Trump is doing when he's, you know, when the policies he's advocating are like that of basically like an early 90s or like 80s Democrat. You know, are the kind of the policies that he's advocating are that. And then suddenly, you know, all of these people who ever since I, you know, the part of the whole reason I started gravitating toward the left when I was, you know, a few years ago was because of their positions on, you know, trade and all of this kind of this stuff, this, you know, anti-imperialism. And then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Trump starts going after all this free trade. And then the response from the media and all these people are like that he's like a nativist. He's like he's ruining our relationship with our allies by like by revamping these trade deals, you know, which were not in our favor to begin with. So like all these trade deals and things that they've wanted to revamp all these years, he's actually doing it. And now they're like saying that he's alienating our allies and friends by doing this. They've totally changed their tune.
Ryan, you wrote an article about Trump's performance so far, and you wrote a list of his accomplishments, his agenda. Out of all the different things, can you comment on what he's done that's positive, and what are your biggest critiques? Obviously, I think Trump's biggest accomplishment so far has been the withdrawal from the TTP. And some of the stuff he's doing, he's starting to do on immigration. Ryan, so far, what has been your take?
I would agree if I had to say, yeah, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, definitely. Anything I'm critical of, it still looks to me like it's an awfully rich, awfully elite cabinet he's got there. You know, I wonder about, okay, I want to represent the common person who's frustrated with the establishment, but then there's a bunch of, like, Goldman Sachs people in the cabinet and so forth. Now, that doesn't automatically mean we're going to get bad policy, but it makes my nose twitch. I'll put it to you that way.
Yeah, it's really hard to predict what he's going to do.
Exactly.
Is he could be very... continue to be friendly towards Wall Street. I know what some people are saying is in order to fight against Wall Street interest, you kind of need one of them to sort of navigate the system. Have you heard that argument?
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that. I tend to agree with Ryan's criticism there, because I think even if he's putting people in those positions and, you know, knowing the kind of guy he is, he's going to just do what he wants anyways. You're still creating an atmosphere of potential like disloyalty and leaks and, you know, people who have their interests conflicting with yours. If you have them in these high positions, they're going to be undermining you. Or, you know, those are the kind of people that will resign and disavow you to the media when you do something, you know, when they get their moment or whatever. You see that happen so many times. So I think that, and during the Bush administration, there was always this kind of, at least in the early years, where you're like, oh, well, you know, oh, he did this, he did that. Like, you know, they must have some secret knowledge or something that they're doing this for a reason or something. And then later we found out that, like, you know, they didn't know jack shit about what they were doing. Like, they were totally winging it, You know, because I remember don't you remember like in the early days of the Iraq War, it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, they must have access to information. They must have a plan for after all of this, you know, and then later on we found out that, you know, they had no idea what they were doing. So I don't like to get to be too optimistic in terms of like, he's got some secret plan, master strategy. Like he knows what he's doing. Like I'm more skeptical of that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm skeptical too. And Trump has been kind of all over the place on these financial issues. On one hand, he's talked about reinstating Glass-Steagall. A while back, I've heard he's even talked about bank nationalization. But then now he's pretty much talking about your standard Republican policies like deregulation of the financial system and deregulation on corporations. So yeah, a lot of that stuff is disturbing. I totally get what Rabbit is saying.
Yeah, I agree. What was the thing that came down recently? Some other kind of something. I forget what it's called, but again, some kind of financial sector regulation that was passed in the early days of the Obama administration.
Dodd-Frank is the one.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, now, well, there's talk of that being repealed. I'm like, are they out of their mind? It wasn't a comprehensive thing to be sure, but it was something.
I haven't read the text of Dodd-Frank, but what I've heard from a lot of financial experts that I respect is that it's not a terrible bill. It's just kind of weak and ineffective. But I can understand replacing it with something better. But you could just scrap it and leave us basically in the situation we were when the financial crash happened.
Well, that, of course, is what the fear is. I mean, do we want to go through that again?
Yeah, I think to me the main area of criticism I have for him is in the foreign policy. I want to see us, you know, get out of all of these foreign conflicts, not start mixing it up with Iran and all these kind of. It would have been great to have a president who just says, you know, I'm just going to restore relations with Iran. You know, by the way, like, you know, sorry we overthrew your democratically elected leader 60 years ago and created all these problems for you. You know, I would like to see him get out of these Middle Eastern conflicts, not even if they're the leaders or whatever are insulting us. Like, he's got to be able to just resist that and say, like, yeah, well, you know, we're just not going to get involved there. Who cares? You know, that's what I want. And that not just for the Middle East, but for a lot of these different conflicts that these neocons just seem like intent on inserting us into and just wanting for like inflammatory rhetoric. I mean, who cares?
I think a lot of Trump's foreign policy views have been incoherent, but what is ironic is that Trump has divided the neocons, thus weakening their power. Because I'll give an example, is some neocons like Trump because Trump is very pro-Israel, much more so than Obama was. And they were pissed off at Obama over his recent decision with the UN and the Israeli settlements. But on the other hand, some of the neocons hate Trump primarily because of his friendliness towards Russia and Putin. But also, Trump has talked about letting Assad stay in power so he can fight ISIS. So even whatever you think about Trump's, I mean, I know what you're saying. Trump has been a saber rattling with Iran, and some of those trends are disturbing. But I do think it is remarkable that Trump has managed to come up with a strategy, whether intentional or not, that has really weakened and divided the neocons' power.
Well, he's made them go, I think, go completely insane because he really. You know, shows you like where their loyalties really are, you know, because they you know, they just, they become unhinged when, you know, over any kind of like criticism of Israel or pro-Russia. I'd have to say that his being pro-Russia is probably the bright spot in his foreign policy. I think that you have all of these people that I think are just you know, if not insane, I just have to question like what their motivation or reasoning could possibly be, like to try to agitate a war with Russia. It's like, you know, these conflicts that Russia is involved in, like they really shouldn't have anything to do with us. Like, you know, it shouldn't even matter one way or the other. So I do think that Trump's willingness to not antagonize Russia, I think, has been a huge bright spot in his foreign policy. I hope that it, you know, that it continues though, and that he doesn't start inserting us into these conflicts that are, you know, that put Russia at odds with us or something. Like, just stay out of it.
Rabbit, what do you think about the whole Muslim ban thing?
Well, I mean, I think it's great. It didn't go far enough. I wish that more countries would have been on there. I would like to see like a complete moratorium on immigration for, 50 years or whatever, like whatever Richard Spencer called for. But, it was, Trump did something at least he's going in the right direction as opposed to, let's increase by the millions how many refugees and people we let in. Like, at least he's going in the right direction, I feel like. And if you remember, after the election, we talked about it. People say, well, you know, why would the alt-right support Trump? You know, clearly he's not with them on all of these issues. And you'll recall that I said that, like, you know, that the reason to support Trump is that because he will take these minor measures, the hysterical reaction to it is then going to escalate things and propel him to do more. And that's exactly what we've seen. He's instituted these very minor, travel bans and whatnot that have sent people rioting and just totally went insane. And that's, I think it's the reaction that he's generated is pushing people to embrace a more extreme position.
And a lot of these SJW types, they're more outraged over an immigration ban than they are over actual war crimes, which is outrageous. I mean, obviously, they did protest against Bush's wars, but they're more outraged over an immigration ban than a lot of the war crimes that were committed during the Obama administration in Libya and Syria.
Yeah, they didn't seem to care when Obama was drone striking people, or when he was bombing Yemen or any of the Libyan conflict. I mean, maybe there was a little bit of like, you know, there was some protestation of that on the far left, but you know, they weren't rioting. They weren't like burning down buildings if he was coming to give a speech somewhere. You know, they weren't attacking the attendees.
Well, the thing of it is, though, is he's black, and you can't criticize him, or else that's racist.
One thing that there's been talk of is Trump using executive orders to reform the H-1B visas, and now there's actually a Democratic congresswoman from California sponsoring a bill that's kind of a compromise between the anti-H-1B visa stance and the Silicon Valley stance. But I heard there's actually been talk of a lot. I read this in an economic article. I'll link to it, but I forget where it was from. But they're talking about the Silicon Valley tech companies actually relocating to Vancouver, Canada. And Ryan, you want to comment on that since you're in Canada?
You know, honestly, I don't really know a lot about that. I almost wonder why they would do such a thing. Do they have so much themselves to gain from unfettered immigration? That seems a strange stance to me. the Muslim ban itself is kind of weird. It certainly isn't that. Numerous Islamic nations or nations with very large Muslim populations, ones with far more Muslims on them than the seven nations specified in the ban, were left off. Indonesia, Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, all of which have over 100 million Muslim citizens not on the ban.
Not to mention the exception for Saudi Arabia.
I was just going to say, Saudi Arabia, conspicuously absent, weren't something like 13 out of 16 of the 9/11 hijackers originally Saudi nationals. Again, the whole thing makes my nose twitch. I've done a little bit of reading into this thing about the petrodollar system. I don't know if any of you have ever studied that. It was something that that was done in Richard Nixon's time. It was a deal that he signed with the House of Saud that, in exchange for U.S. protection and a few other goodies, Saudi Arabia would conduct all of its oil trade in U.S. dollars. And since then, a number of other OPEC nations have been signatories to this. And what this has done, for all intents and purposes, has made the U.S. dollar an oil-backed currency. And there's a school of thought about petrodollar warfare, which suggests that a lot of this intervention in the Middle East is being undertaken with the intention of kind of preserving this system or of punishing nations that sort of withdrawal from it. I mean, that's quite possibly why there's all of this saber rattling going on with Iran now. I just recently read an article talking about Iran. They're not going to use U.S. dollars for anything. And it's like, well, you can see where this is going to go now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One of the other issues has been the Dakota Access pipeline from Canada to the United States. And I talked about that with you earlier. I kind of have mixed feelings about it because on one hand, I think it's definitely preferable from getting oil from Saudi Arabia. But on the other hand, I think it would continue our dependence on a petroleum-based economy. And we really need to get serious about alternative energy. And I don't think Trump is, if you look at his choices for energy and the EPA. But to be honest, I have kind of mixed feelings about that pipeline.
Yeah. And I certainly wouldn't look to Canada, Alberta in particular, to be a model upon which to base your energy policy. Look at what something like Norway did, say, in the early to mid-70s. They nationalized most of their oil production and have since used the profits to establish a sovereign wealth fund, which they invest not only in their own oil trade and their own markets, but all over the world. I believe it's called the Norwegian Pension Fund or something to that effect, and it's one of the one of the largest and most successful funds in Europe. Apparently, it's one of the more successful ones in the world, as a matter of fact. And they're just laughing fiscally as a result of having something like this. Whereas here in Canada, well, in Alberta in particular, we have a very neocon sort of small C conservative political culture up here. So even talk of raising the royalties just a little bit provokes a huge backlash from a very entrenched corporate oil company culture and a generally right-leaning public mood overall. And as a result, we're continuing to have a lot of financial difficulty here in Alberta, my own home province. It's been mismanaged quite considerably.
I know Alaska did that on a small scale. Obviously, they didn't nationalize their oil, but they do have a citizens' dividend based off of oil income. And ironically, it was Sarah Palin who did that. I don't think I don't think she did so on deep intellectual grounds. She just did it because it was a good way to get elected and to be popular. But I thought about that because where I live in Santa Barbara, we have these oil rigs off the coast. And just think about all that wealth going to these multinational oil corporations. If that revenue went to the state funds, I mean, our taxes would be much lower. We would have much better social services. And I don't think there's been any major political figure in the United States advocating that. Has there been anyone in Canada who's advocated oil nationalization?
Not certainly in my recollection. I mean, we have an NDP government here, social democratic ideologically. So theoretically, you would think that they would be interested in something like that, but you don't really hear much out of them. They seem to be quite tepid regarding any of this type of thing, as a matter of fact. I find myself wondering why any nation with those kinds of resources wouldn't do something like that. It's been very successful in Norway.
Ryan, are you familiar with the social credit movement in Canada?
Vaguely, yes. My own home province of Alberta had a social credit government for quite some time. I forget when they were first elected, sometime back in the 30s, and they were finally defeated by the Progressive Conservatives in 1971. Now, my understanding of it was that their policies were not, for the most part, based on social credit theory. In practice, the Alberta SoCreds were basically small-c conservatives.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that the social credit movement in Britain got fairly large, but that it was it ended up being, I think, largely consumed by Oswald Mosley and the Black Shirts. A lot of it, they absorbed a lot of those people into it, but yeah, I wonder why we haven't seen such much of a resurgence of that social credit movement. I thought it found it fairly interesting.
Rabbit, you live in Phoenix, which obviously it's a city in the Sun Belt, and I'm in Southern California. What do you think about the issue of solar energy?
I mean, I'm very supportive of it. Energy policy isn't something that like really interests me a whole lot. Like, to be honest, I'm kind of like you though, in that I support more environmentally friendly and even just more more futurist type energy sources as opposed to burning oil and things like that. Like, what's interesting, you said you had mixed feelings about the Dakota Access Pipeline, because I do also, but the way that it's framed is not through the environmental sense or even the economic. It's the issue is framed that it's like that it's the white man, infringing on the Native American, poisoning the Native American's land. That's how it is framed in the media. And that's like, when it's framed that way, my force field goes up and I automatically, am inclined to side with, with the white people, even though, tribally, just because it's just another incidence of like, oh, this is colonialism, the white man, hegemony over these Native Americans and, stealing their resources from the earth, and whatnot. I just think it's framed through that. It automatically puts you in a difficult position, because if they were going to argue it based upon environmental reasons or any of that, I would be more receptive to the arguments. But now I'm automatically put on the side of, well, screw you guys. Like,
I mean, I totally acknowledge that the Native Americans were historically screwed over, but white liberals have this sort of fetishization of American Indians as sort of upholders of the environment. And where I live in Santa Barbara, there's this Chumash Reservation, and you just have this really beautiful area up in the Santa Ynez Mountains, and then you're driving through the mountains and this really beautiful area. Then you just see this big, giant, ugly Indian casino there. And it just ruins the whole landscape.
Yeah, and, you know, granted, well, they didn't, in the deals and whatnot, they didn't really, you know, they didn't get the greatest land. But, you know, I hate that argument because it's like, you know, take it what you've got and make something out of it. You know, the pioneers and people who the frontiersmen that came to this country, like, you know, they just went into like no man's land and built up civilizations there. So it's like, you know, after, you know, hundreds of years, you know, come on, like, you know, do something with the land. Like you can find, even if, you know, if those frontiersmen or pioneers were sent to a deserted island, they would find a way to make it into a civilization. Like, you know, at a certain point, like it's, you know, the fact that it's just an eyesore, it's like, it's not my problem anymore. It's not my fault.
Referring to Rob is a very strong tendency towards romanticism on the left in the English speaking world. It's that old idea, that old trope of the noble savage. They never really got rid of this. Of course, they would never dare refer to it in precisely those terms. But by and large, it's essentially what it is. The whole sort of idealization of the foreign, the indigenous, the feminine, you know, all of these things are put up on pedestals and kind of positively contrasted with, you know, certainly with the Caucasian, with the European, with either the secular rational strain of European thought stemming from the Enlightenment or from the older, say, Greco-Roman or Judeo-Christian tradition or whatever. All of that stuff is kind of frowned on, whereas anything supposedly foreign or ethnic or different or whatever is cool. And this has very, very, very deep roots in supposed progressive thinking in the Western world.
I was up at a Nevada Falls in Yosemite, and the only diversity I saw was a group of a tourist from Japan and a white guy with his Asian girlfriend.
Was it Pill Eater?
No, don't go there. I took that as offense.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, you see that kind of, you know, romanticization a lot in like the writings of the Beat Generation, where you see it's you see why they get accused of being like a romantic racist or whatever. If you like to take Jack Kerouac's like On the Road, for example, there's like, you know, he basically talks gushingly about some of these different groups of people. Like he talks about how he envies, you know, this blacks in a way, but the way that he talks about it, he goes on a big long spiel. The things that like he envies them because he thinks because they're so carefree and like simple minded, you know, and almost like, you know, childlike, where he complains that like all his own dreams and ambitions were like, he called them like, he always had, you know, like white dreams, you know, where it basically like they were complex and like weighing him down. And he wishes that he could be like these, simple minded people that just live for fun, you know, and whatnot. So it's like, on the one hand, it's like romanticizing it, but it's also, you know, you can see where there is a race realism there in its own way.
Rabbit, do you think there are parallels to the beatniks and some of these early 60s counterculture icons and the alt-left?
I mean, I think so in the sense that it's that there is like, you know, there is an implicitness about it where, you know, where you see these groups. For me, anyways, even if you take Vietnam, for example, you know, you could take a lot of the arguments for us not being involved in the Vietnam War, and for not wanting us to get involved, and that you know, the Vietnamese, they have a right to self-determination and all this to determine their own future, and it's like, you know, that I identify with that stuff, but you know, for some reason, like, you're not allowed to apply that to these European countries.
Yeah, there was no outrage when Bill Clinton bombed Serbia because it was a white Christian country.
Right, exactly. But also, you know, if you took the arguments that like someone in the 60s should use for like how Vietnam should be able to determine its future, you know, away outside of interference, and like what, you know, nobody would have had a problem with, and in fact, many of these countries, you know, do control their borders, like Cuba and these other countries. No one would have had a problem with these countries wanting their self-determination. So I view the same mindset. It's just that I view it from the perspective of like a person in my own country or my own city.
Ryan, where do you see the direction of the alt-left going in regards to a lot of the issues that we've talked about, including some of the infighting and also the anti-Trump rioting?
Well, my observation has been that the people who, you know, I know the mainstays in the left, alt-left groups that I am a part of are just looking at this whole rioting business and saying, you know, what the hell are you people doing? Because sooner or later, they're going to provoke a crackdown. It might come from the National Guard, or it might come from some ad hoc organized citizens groups. Who are kind of getting frustrated with the police not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Just as a bit of an aside, I read today that the FBI has begun an investigation into Berkeley's mayor, apparently ordering the police to stand down when the rioting began. So in any event, the public is going to get so frustrated with this, and it's going to be very, very catastrophic for the left in, you know, in the United States, at least, if they don't start getting real here.
And I think, yeah, it's bad for both sides because they could see from their perspective, you could see a massive crackdown on the left. But from our perspective, too, then a lot of political dissidents who are anti-status minded, different people, even on the left, libertarian-minded people, they're going to see Trump as this authoritarian, right-wing, fascist figure, and then they're going to associate us with authoritarianism. So it's going to divide people who are political dissidents rather than creating more barriers to a cohesive dissident movement.
Yeah, it will legitimize SJW and even Antifa narratives regarding Trump. It has every danger of being a self-fulfilling prophecy. It will not end well in any event.
I have a question about the Antifa. I was really interested. This came up to my mind, but it seems like the Antifa, you know, we've seen at the Milo event and some other things, it's usually all white. Now, compared to Black Lives Matter, we have it's all blacks rioting, and the word on the alt-right, it's a chimp out, right? Now, what's funny is because when the Antifa come, it's all white, and I'm thinking to myself, this might be the white equivalent of a chimp out. However, the motivation for anyone in the Antifa actually comes from the hardcore punk scene, or at least reading anarchist theory. However, I think what do you think about like why the Antifa is motivated, or do you think, because what I think is I think the Antifa is really coming from this small niche urbanite city group of music, rather. They like punk music and they read like Crime Think and Days of War, Nights of Love, and they think anarchy is the way to go. But when practiced in reality, it seems to be this ultimate narrative of fighting against fascism and racism, or this never-ending struggle like Robin Hood. I think it really is this kind of problematic thing that I think urbanite whites are having, and it's letting them clog, and I think it's damaging themselves or something.
Yeah, that's the and again, I mean, what basis is there for this in even classic anarchist theory? Have they read, say, Mikhail Bakunin? Are they familiar with the disputes that he had with Karl Marx that resulted in the communist-anarchist split in the first place?
Nah, that's the thing.
They're sure the hell not seizing the means of production out there, I'll tell you that.
I think,
again, it's very self-destructive.
Yeah, I think that there's also they have this mythology almost where they have they're under the impression that somehow that, like, you know, fascism rose up last time because they let the fascists like come to power and they didn't get violent with them, when in reality, like, these movements like the brown shirts and like the black shirts and all of that, like, those groups came, those like paramilitary like factions and things, those came about because you know, those groups would just try to have speeches and rallies, and these communists and, you know, I guess they wouldn't have been anarchists at that time, but they would attack these rallies, and, you know, in the same way that they do now when someone speaks or whatever, so that these fascists you know, started forming these protective groups, you know, that morphed into like these paramilitary forces. So it's not like, you know, in the 1920s and 30s that you just had these like gangs of paramilitary black shirts that just went around beating people. And then, you know, they eventually took power. Like, no, it was like those groups were formed because they needed protection for their rallies and things, their marches that they were holding. And so in fact, they think that they're doing something different, but what they really are doing is they're repeating history. And then, you know, these other alt-right groups and whatnot are, you know, they're going to start, you know, bringing some muscle to these rallies and being more organized and being prepared for these people that come here with like knives and poles and mace and whatnot. Like, they're going to be more prepared for that stuff. So it's just really just history kind of repeating itself.
Yeah.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Ryan Englund for being on. We've covered a lot of interesting topics.
Thank you for having me.
And also thanks, Robin and Pillater.
Nice talking to you.
Same.